Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and this installment of the Heretics Hour is a live broadcast. Yes, I'm coming to you in real time from my home in Texas on this Monday evening, May 23rd. Tonight, I want to cover some ideas about Holocaust. Notice that I'm saying Holocaust and not the Holocaust. I've been hearing people, revisionists, certain ones, usually Europeans, referring to it as Holocaust, and I kind of thought, well, that's the European way of saying it, but really, I like the sound of that, and I'm going to take it up as my own, because now it has a lot more meaning to me than to say the Holocaust. And I'm going to talk in some detail about Holocaust tonight, and I'm really happy to have the opportunity to do so. Holocaust is the proper way to say it, because it's not really any longer just an historical event. Holocaust is a state of mind. It has become a political ideology. Of course, we know it's a religion. And in fact, it represents the entire modern outlook of today. And also, this is a dangerous outlook for us, for European white people, and for all people of the world, actually. Even though we are the ones who seem to be most victimized by it, all people are endangered by it, because Holocaust is what has bred the wars that we've had since the end of World War II. It has bred the kind of domination of our world by the victors, the United States, Israel, and Britain participates in that. And the other nations have to go along, pretty much have to go along. So this Holocaust is really a big, big thing. And people who say that they would like to, let's not talk about it. Now, that, for one thing, is just an impossibility to me. But also, it's something, and I'm going to quote a particular revisionist that I've become very fond of in a little while. But, you know, it is very clear to him that we must talk about it, and we must talk about it more than we have been, and more strongly, and with more force than we have done up to now. Because Holocaust is not something that we can ever accept and have, at the same time, a sane world going forward. In fact, most of us, and many, many, many people, are aware and are very concerned that our world is getting worse and worse instead of better. Think terrible things are taking place right in front of our eyes. I mean, the chutzpah of what goes on. For example, this Osama bin Laden killing recently, and that's just one example of things that are thrown in our faces, and we're like, what? You know, what are we supposed to think about this? And there's really no way to, there's very little opportunity to express a different viewpoint. Now, I've been talking to many terrific people about Holocaust, and they are really wonderful, wonderful people. And they're expressing themselves more openly in more places about the subject than ever before. I see that happening, but of course we have a long way to go to get the attention of the public. Now, the first thing I'm going to say tonight that is that I'm really glad that I have the that I can say it here where I am to you, and that is that there was no Holocaust. Okay? So why do so many revisionists say, of course there was a Holocaust? They are adamant about that, some of them. And many people who follow revisionism and are what I call kind of half-hearted revisionists, but they're sincere, they're doing what they think is right, but they are adamant that that there was a Holocaust. And they will always say, oh, of course, I don't deny there was a Holocaust. Of course, I know there was a Holocaust. I am just saying that, well, I disagree with how many Jews died in the Holocaust. Okay, and then they talk about that. Or I disagree that there were gas chambers. That has not been proven. And then they talk about that. And they also, the other big threesome is, I don't think there was a written order. It's never been proven that there was a written order. And so, I don't think there was not even there's any order. There was never any order from, Hitler, who would have to have approved of this. So therefore, while I believe in the Holocaust, they say, I don't think it's the way that it's been portrayed. Well, I ask, if there were no gas chambers, let's start there, how can there have been a Holocaust? You know, this word bothers me. So when I say there was no Holocaust, I am really referring to the word Holocaust. It means a holy burnt offering. And it is used in the Old Testament, I understand. I don't know that I've looked for that recently, but I have heard other people say that it's in the Old Testament. And, of course, I know I do understand all of that. I used to read the Bible quite a bit, and I do know that they had all these burnt offerings and that it had to be a holy burnt offering to the Lord for it to be pleasing to God. So, therefore, that is the word holo or whole cost or burning, holy burnt. Now, I read just the other day that what happened is that the Jews were forcibly deported out of Germany to the east. And this person said, this was someone, you know, speaking about it, this can be a Holocaust to some. I don't remember who it was that said that. But I thought, no, it can't. No, it can't. Why do we do this? Why do we talk like this? Why do we say that we can call it a Holocaust if it was simply a deportation of Jews because they suffered because of it? That cannot be a Holocaust. So I say we have to change this word. Now, many people will say to me, oh, my goodness, you're asking for too much. You know, we can't start out there because then you'll be called a denier. Then you'll be attacked. And so, you know, we just have to work with the word and try to get people to understand. No, I don't agree, all right? And I do have some allies in this. Now, to go on with this word, Shoah is the other word that the Jewish people use. It's a Hebrew word, and it literally means destruction. Now, perhaps this is why Raoul Hilberg wrote his book, his famous one of, he wrote what was considered, the classic of Holocaust historians in setting forth the whole picture of the Holocaust. But he titled it The Destruction of the European Jews. But were the European Jews destroyed? They still existed immediately after the war, many, many of them. And they moved they're all over the world today. They didn't seem to have lost or decreased by enough that they could not replenish themselves very quickly and now are a huge force in the world. So there's no way that they were destroyed. But the only thing that happened was that their communities were emptied to some extent. They were dispersed here and there. And in a lot of cases, they did not return to their communities because they didn't want to. Because their communities were in Russia and in Eastern European countries where they were not particularly popular and not particularly liked, and they didn't have that many opportunities. And now they had the opportunity after the war, after the concentration camps, to go to other places where they'd much prefer to go, not only Palestine, but of course the United States and many other countries, but mostly Palestine and the United States, which were much more favorable to them for them becoming economically, to go on an upward economic spiral. So these communities existed, but they were not the way they were. And so this was not what you could say. You can't really say that they were destroyed. Now, Shoah also can be sometimes defined as the word catastrophe. There's not much difference, although there is a little difference. And sometimes it's called a catastrophe of destruction or the destructive catastrophe, whatever. But it was supposedly, to the Jewish mind, a catastrophe for the Jews. However, we must be aware that throughout the history that the Jews give as their history, there have been innumerable catastrophes that they have recorded for themselves. So this is not, maybe not even the worst one, but it is definitely the one they want us to think is the worst one, and they want us to think that they were destroyed in this, even though they are still very much alive. So, but now, to go on, Elie Wiesel, to my understanding, is the first who used the word Holocaust. Now, he says he was, and some other people have said he was, and I have not actually researched that to find out just when he first said that, and if anybody said that before him, it's not that important, but he is considered to be the one. And, of course, as I already said, Holocaust is from the Bible. Well, now, why do we accept Elie Wiesel's word for what happened? Well, that's a question I can't even answer. But I would say that we are way too willing. This is my point. We are way, way too willing to accept the language that they give us for what happened. And we have been way too willing to accept their version. And we very timidly try to question their version without ever saying, oh, I don't believe your version, or really saying what all that's wrong with it and why it's basically basically made up. And, well, that's another area to go into that I'm not exactly going to go into tonight. But we don't say that. Instead, we just kind of skirt around and try to get them to agree that they are exaggerating what happened. Well, do you think they're going to agree with that? Now, I want to talk more about Elie Wiesel later in the program, but I still ask why we continue to call whatever happened at that time a Holocaust, if you are at the same time refuting gas chambers, refuting burning pits, refuting anything where people are being burned in order to be murdered, but they're only dying of gunshot wounds or disease or the other things that there is some evidence of, but how much is of it is another question. But so why do we allow this word Holocaust to continue? This is accepting the Jewish control of our language, which I have more to say about too. I think my number one point and my number one effort that I'm going to be making is to encourage people to, well, deny the Holocaust. Now, this is the very thing that we're not supposed to do, and the very thing that the majority of revisionists insist that they are not doing. Now, to me, you see, this is a losing proposition. And Jews are clever people, and also those non-Jews who are interested in keeping Holocaust alive, because, as I said, it's a political ideology. It's a political, it's the way that the entire modern world is kept in place because of it. And so this, I think, we have to attack at the base, at the source. We have to attack the word Holocaust. We have to refuse to use the word Holocaust. We have to come up with a different word, our own word. We can call it the deportation of the Jews from Germany. That may not, you know, there may be many, many choices. I haven't actually thought about that. But I think that we need to accept the word denier as it is thrown at us and say, yes, I do deny what you are calling the Holocaust. I deny that such a thing ever happened. Cringing? Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm not denying anything. We are afraid of the word denier, and we are afraid of the word anti-Semite. And there's probably a few more I could come up with, but I don't want to try to cover too much. Now, recently I did an interview with a French revisionist named Vincent Renoir. His name is pronounced, his name is spelled R-E-Y-N-O-U-A-R-D. I always thought that name was just, would be just impossible for me to pronounce, because it seemed like it would have to be something like Ray Noir, but in some very Frenchy-sounding way. But it turns out he says it Renoir, and that's like the French Impressionist painter, Auguste Renoir. So although his is just slightly different, but not enough that you would even notice, now I can say his name very easily, Vincent Renoir. Now, he is a man, he's really after my own heart. You know, I did not realize before this interview that he was quite as direct and powerful and brave and truthful as he is. And he doesn't hide from anything. And so he recently did an interview with on French. Well, I don't know if it was on French television. It was covered. There was a video on the internet that I just looked at today, and I asked a friend who knows various languages. Thank goodness I have some people who are willing to give me the meaning of things in different languages at times to tell me what was just the gist of what Vincent was saying in this rather long interview that this news person or somebody was doing on in this video, and this is very recent. And what this friend who knows French told me was he was saying, be straight to the point with the truth before the lies destroy our children's world. Attack instead of merely defending. Now, that's only part of it. I have more to go, but I'll comment on that. Be straight to the point with the truth before the lies destroy our children's world. Friends, I talked in the beginning that all the wars and all of the terrible things that have been going on since the end of World War II, which was supposed to have brought peace, democracy, happiness, and well-being to all the people of the world, what has been going on since then is really horrendous. And our children's world is just horrible and only getting worse. And yet, we are unwilling to face head on these lies. There's something very wrong. There's something really wrong with us if we really think about this. Now, he says attack instead of merely defending. Wonderful. That's what I've been saying. I've been thinking this for some time, but he's giving me the courage to just come right out with it. Because, you know, we have been defending. We are defending. And we need to go on the attack. I think so. He then says, don't ask the system to respect our right of free speech, since that's out of the question for we who are enemies of the lie, without which the system itself would die. So he's saying, you know, if we are asking for which we are doing, most are doing. We want the right to a free speech, or we want the right of debate. And I respect all those who have been doing this, and they have been holding the fort, so to speak, but they have not been making progress. And I think that's very plain, that we have not made progress, and the people who are saying, just allow us to debate openly, are not really making progress. We need to not ask, he says, for this right. He says, because it will never be given to us. It will never be given to us, because if we had the right, if there were open and free debate on this question, on Holocaust, the system would die, because as I explained, and I do think I'm right, this is the underpinning of the entire system. Without Holocaust, this system can't stand. And more can be said about that. But now, Vincent goes on, or this is the translator's words to me as to the essence of what Vincent was saying. The last sentence, don't view the expression of the historical truth in the context of some abstract right, but rather as a concrete duty. Oh, I love that. We're not asking, we're not seeing it as, well, we have a right to speak out, but we should see it as we have a duty to speak out. We have a duty to defend, I'm using the word defend, but to defend our children's future by attacking this lie, this hoax, this political ideology, religion, construct of Holocaust that has been established. And of course, I know that it is coming out from every source of media. It has been permeating our thinking, our understanding, what we hear, what we read, day and night for since 1945, and so people are just infused with it. But I do believe that as soon as people forcefully speak out the truth, I mean the real truth, and without tiptoeing around it, this can fall so fast, because it's already been absolutely riddled by the wonderful work of the revisionists up until now. Just riddled. But we need more people not to be rude, not to just scream out liar, liar. Sometimes that word is proper, I think, because that's what they are, certain ones, and I'm going to talk about one later in the second half, but not to just be crude about it. Let's not be crude, but let's be very clear and direct, and let's not allow them to give us the language that we have to use. Real quickly before we take our break, I will just point out that Eric Hunt, who has named his website HolocaustDenier.com, because he is one of the people who subscribes to this view, he has just completed and put online his second draft, which is in a sense a final draft, but he doesn't want to call it a final draft because it's always open to still some improvements, he thinks. So he's calling his second draft of his film The Last Days of the Big Lie. And if you go to HolocaustDenier.com or to the other website, revisionistworkshop.com, it will be right there, pop right up in front of you, and you can watch it. And I see now that he also has it divided up into segments, shorter segments, and he has been able to upload it on YouTube. Earlier he said that he was banned on YouTube, but maybe the shorter ones are allowed. So he's got all the information there, and you can follow it. And Eric takes the aggressive approach, and yet he has this film, as most of you probably have already seen it. But the more you do look at it, I looked at the new second draft yesterday. all the way through. And there are quite a few changes and additions from what things that he didn't have in it before. And it is just, it is so powerful. It is so convincing. If you can get people to watch it, that's the thing. I told him that I was going to try to get a DVD of it, and well, I can do that, and set up a showing in my public library. I don't see why I can't do that. I don't know if they will allow it, but I understand that they're supposed to do that, so I'll use that on them. But I would be very interesting to see how many people would come to see it, and I would show it in probably two parts, because it's 2 hours long, and that's a long time for people to sit. I might have to divide it up into smaller sections. But anyway, come back in 3 minutes. We'll be back with you.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Speech to the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC. President Obama said Israel will face growing isolation without a credible Middle East peace process. He repeated his call too for the Jewish state to return to pre-1967 borders with the Palestinians, including mutual land swaps, in order to reach peace in the conflict. The idea, though, was flatly rejected by the Israeli Prime Minister. Let's get more on this. Talk to John Mearsheimer. He's a political analyst and expert on U.S.-Israeli relations, joining us on the line from Chicago tonight. Mr. Mearsheimer, very good evening from RT. It's good to have you on the program. During today's speech, President Obama repeatedly expressed friendship again towards Israel and commitment to its security. But, you know, considering the recent disagreements we've seen, is that rather a smokescreen hiding a growing rift in relations, do you think, these days?
Well, ever since President Obama took office in January 2009, he has been fighting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over, number one, settlement expansion, and over, number two, the two-state solution. The fact is that Bibi Netanyahu has no interest in the two-state solution, and he has no interest in slowing down the building of settlements. And President Obama, like his two predecessors, is deeply committed to a two-state solution. So there's a fundamental difference of agreement here, and this is just the most recent example of the two of them going toe-to-toe.
Well, you know, despite stating, as I mentioned there, the unwavering support for Israel, President Obama also said that the state will be left in isolation if the peace process doesn't come in earnest. John, let's just listen to what President Obama had to say for a second.
The march to isolate Israel international and the impulse of the Palestinians to abandon negotiations will continue to gain momentum in the absence of a credible peace process and alternative. We can't afford to wait another decade, or another two decades, or another three decades to achieve peace. The world is moving too fast.
Well, John, the president is sounding pretty clear there. Certainly, you know, the rhetoric's being ramped up. Do you think the U.S. itself would withhold its support if Israel doesn't agree to peace on Washington's terms, these new terms being called for?
For the foreseeable future, there's virtually no chance that the United States will stop supporting Israel unconditionally. The Israel lobby is just too powerful in this country for any president to really get tough with Israel. But what President Obama was saying very clearly is that Israel is being isolated around the world, and the Palestinians are gaining the upper hand in terms of world opinion. And what's going to happen here is that it's going to be Israel and the United States against the rest of the world. This is disastrous for the United States.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, I am Carolyn Yeager, and I remind you again that I am coming to you live tonight, and it's a fun experience. Now, I am talking about Holocaust tonight, and the next person that I would like to bring up is Kenneth Walzer. For those of you who don't know who Kenneth Walzer is, he is one of Michigan State University's professors who is an expert, they say, in studying and teaching about the Holocaust. You notice they call it the Holocaust. Walzer teaches history in James Madison College at Michigan State University, and he directs the Jewish Studies program there. And his course, Jews and Anti-Semitism, aims to increase student knowledge about Jewish history and the history of anti-Semitism and their relation to one another. And, of course, in Jewish history, anti-Semitism has always existed, and they have always been persecuted because of it and for no reason, and that is why they have the history that they do, according to them. And it says on the website, his website for Michigan State, that he equates students with the profound and distinctive tragedy of the Holocaust. Now, you know, first I ask, why are our university students being taught about the Holocaust at the expense of other more important things that they could be learning? I mean, for one thing, since beginning in the 70s and certainly since the 80s, many, many states have mandated Holocaust education in the public schools. And I know that in my town where I live, and I investigated the schools here, and I talked to the teachers. I did a real deal of it, and they didn't know my views, and so they were willing to talk to me once I started kind of revealing a little bit that I wasn't too sold on all that they were doing, they really cut me off, and nobody would talk to me anymore after that. But I learned enough because they start, as they willingly told me with such pride, in first grade, you know, sort of slowly imparting these kinds of ideas. And in the fourth grade, there is an all-out big section of Holocaust studies, and they look at videos, they read books, all for, you know, in line with fourth graders. Now, we know that fourth grade is the ideal place to indoctrinate children, because when you reach the fourth grade, you are at the age of reasoning and thinking. Third grade is, you're a little bit too young, but fourth grade you're not. And then at the same time, you're very idealistic and impressionable and sympathetic to all living things and so on. I mean, this is the typical fourth grader, and I can remember myself in fourth grade. As a matter of fact, when I think of my own schooling, I think that I was the nicest person I've ever known myself to be in the fourth grade. But we did not have Holocaust education, thank goodness, when I was in school. But now they do. And then again in the eighth grade, they have another big section on Holocaust. And then in high school, it's up to teachers, but usually in history, history of World War II, history of the world history, so on. And also in literature, in English classes, teachers often select Holocaust literature for the students to read. But that's kind of up to the teacher. But this is the way it is in my community. Anyway, getting back to Kenneth Walzer, I want to talk about him because I have had some brief dealings with him, and I have written about him a little bit, and he is really someone who I think needs to be focused on, because he has promised and said he's writing a book. He's a very big fan of Elie Wiesel, and you know I have the Elie Wiesel website, Elie Wiesel Cons the World at www.ellieweaseltattoo.com. And I will not go into in that right at the moment, but some of what I've got here is taken from there. Anyway, he is writing this book, The Rescue of Children and Youth at Buchenwald. He said, now, I have it here from his website, that in May 2008, he did a lecture at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum describing this underground rescue operation at Buchenwald of the children who were at Buchenwald, of whom he says Elie Wiesel was one of them. And he was doing this because his book was, he was working on this book and it was going to be out soon. I remember him saying back in 2007 and 2008 that his book was, you know, be out pretty soon. That's how I remember it. Anyway, now it's May 2011 and there is no book. That's 3 years since May 2008, and I think it was even in 2007 that he was talking about this book. Now, I want to point out that on Scrapbook Page's blog, he left a comment on one of the articles, and this was in October 4th, 2010, last year. And there were some blogs written about Elie Wiesel and about the Buchenwald story and so on. And he wrote and said, all the prattle about Elie Wiesel not being at Auschwitz or Buna or at Buchenwald, which is what is on my website and what is claimed on my website that I just mentioned to you, he says they're false. This is all false. And he says, Miklos Gruner's claim that Lazar Wiesel was an older man, born 1913, 1920, and not in 1928, are false. He says, a colleague and I have proved beyond a doubt that Elie Wiesel is indeed the Lazar Wiesel in the records at Buchenwald and in the ITS at Bad Errolson, and that his account of his experience in Buchenwald in Night, in his book Night, you know, Elie Wiesel's famous book Night, fits closely with the documented facts. And he says, stay tuned. And he says, he adds, for those interested, I'm still working on the book on rescue of children and youths at Buchenwald. Now, he made this comment himself because he does read this stuff, and there was some criticism about him on that thread and on a few others and about the Wiesel at Buchenwald story, and so this was his answer. Well, on my at my Elie Wiesel Cons the World website, I ran an article in November 2010 that was titled Signatures Prove Lazar Wiesel is Not Elie Wiesel. And I showed signatures taken from Elie Wiesel's known signature, and also I had there a signature from this the only record at Buchenwald that has Lazar Wiesel's name at the liberation when at the liberation when they were doing questionnaires on all these people that, you know, that all these survivors that were there. And this signature does not match in any way, shape, or form Elie Wiesel's current signatures, and it's so far different that it's kind of hard to even imagine that it could be the same person, you know, at a later date. Now, Ken Walzer actually wrote a comment to this article, and he said this on November 14, 2010. And it's still there. You can look it up if you go to that, if you go to that article. Contrary to Carolyn Yeager's wishful thinking, Elie Wiesel was indeed the Lazar Wiesel who was admitted to Buchenwald on January 26, 1945. Who was subsequently shifted to Block 66, and who was interviewed by military authorities before being permitted to leave Buchenwald to go with other Buchenwald orphans to France. Furthermore, there is not a shadow of a doubt about this, he says, although the Buchenwald records do erroneously contain, on some pieces, the birth date of 1913 rather than 1928. And he says, now that, he says, that's just an error. It's an error that on these Buchenwald records, the birth date for this Lazar Wiesel is given as 1913 rather than Elie Wiesel's birth date of 1928. And he says on some pieces, well, on there are no pieces of documents at Buchenwald that show any Wiesel born in 1928. So he's a little bit, he's being a little bit ingenuous there. Then he continues, a forthcoming paper. See, now he's referring to something that he's writing. A forthcoming paper resolves the riddle of Lazar, in quotes, and indicates that Miklos Gruner's stolen identity, that's the book he wrote, is a set of false charges and attack on Wiesel without any foundation. Well, you know, I couldn't disagree more with Ken Walzer, and I find it astounding that he is a professor at a major, well, at Michigan State University, certainly not a nowhere place, in Jewish studies, and he is considered, you know, an expert on all of these things, that he would write such unsubstantiated stuff in a comment. But you see, he doesn't like to be under attack, and he feels like he must defend himself, although I have not gotten him to write any further comments, unfortunately. I think somebody must have advised him to stop doing it. But anyway, this was 6 months ago that he wrote this. Now, where is the paper? He said he and another person writing this paper. How long does it take to write a paper? And plus, there's no word on this paper. And on his before I go further with this, I will give my answer to these questions. What I think happened was that he has realized that what he has is not going to fly, it is not going to work, and it may very well be, now I'm just speculating here, that these signatures that I came up with are what is stopping him, because I have not had the money to have a signature done by a handwriting expert. Because the experts that you would need to have to be all, you know, the ones with all the, you know, registered and so on to carry any weight. And they charge $2,000. I inquired quite a few. They charge $2,000 just for the in advance. And then they give you a couple of hours or something. And then if they need any more time, which they shouldn't on this, then, you know, they charge you more. But they all did. They have a set fee. I guess they all agree on this. So I wasn't going to spend $2,000. I couldn't spend $2,000, and neither could the sponsor of the website. And so we have not done one. But he certainly has plenty of money, because he works for the Holocaust lobby, the Holocaust industry. He not only has his professor's salary, but he has, no doubt, unlimited money, because he goes to Bad Errolson and does all this research, and he's trying to prove all these things about what happened for the Holocaust industry, and yet he seems not being able to do it because he hasn't published anything. Now, but he may have had those signatures. Excuse me. He may have had those signatures checked by experts, and they may have said, no, these cannot be the same person. So, that's my speculation, because, of course, we were not going to get an answer from him. But on his MSU website, which I'll take a look at now, he has several pages on in the classroom. And he has a page on Elie Wiesel that you can go to. And I copied this on another article that I did there. He claims that this picture, and I did it also an article right before the signatures article on these supposed photographs of Elie Wiesel in Buchenwald. And he has a picture there, which I have in the article also, of these so-called Buchenwald orphans, young boys, or boys, not too young, walking out, marching to the gate or somewhere, you know, with their mentors to leave. And he claims that one of these is Elie Wiesel, and of course it doesn't look anything like Elie Wiesel, and there's a lot of, there are several pictures of Elie Wiesel that were supposed to be him in the Buchenwald camp, and they don't look, well, there's two there, and they don't look anything alike, so they can't both be Elie Wiesel, and I say they're neither one of them are Elie Wiesel. So this man has still got this stuff here, but he says nothing about his book. He's just silent about it. And I think people should write to him and ask him why he can't come up with his book. What happened to it? It's very strange. I wanted to bring that up because I am saying that he is, he simply can't write the book. He can't finish the book because he's such, okay, here's the reason. I think, now I'm speculating again, but if I were not doing what I was doing, and if some others were not also being very very vigilant about what these people are doing, such as Eric Hunt is one, and it's not just others too, that he thinks he probably would have come out with his book and gotten away with it because it would have gotten all this media press favorable, and there, you know, people would be, all these well-known names would have been giving praise to it and so on without ever reading it. And there would have been no problem. Because most of the stuff that's come out up till now has been full of inaccuracies, but they've gotten away with it, so to speak. But now there's concern that they will not get away with it because we are there and we are capable of doing the research and proving them wrong. And this is why it is important to be aggressive in this and not just sit on the defense and go along with their terminology and try to get them to admit a few little things, which they're never going to admit, but to realize that, as Vincent Raynor says, we don't ask for the right to do it. We just do it, and we do it as a duty for our children and our children's future, and for the world. And as I said again, I'll say again, this is not just for the white people of the world who are being accused of this Holocaust crime, but it will benefit all the world, even though at this time many of them do not know that. They think that Holocaust benefits them in some way, but they will find that everything will change if Holocaust can be shown to be the actual hoax that it is. All right, now I have a few more, 10 more minutes, I think, and I want to go to the work I'm doing on Dennis Abbey. I have written several articles in the last month on this Dennis Abbey, who has written a book that has now come out called The Man Who Broke Into Auschwitz. Now, I have called him a Holocaust hoaxer, I have even called him a liar. I have associated him with BBC and with the British Labour Party, who were in control of the government during, up until just recently when the Conservative Party took over. But up, you know, for what? How many years was Tony Blair and Gordon Brown in power? And during this time, this man started telling his story, this Dennis Abbey, and he got on TV, and then the BBC was really behind him to try to authenticate his story. And I've told that story as best I can. And also the story of how the Holocaust Education Trust, which is a Jewish organization in Britain, has been behind Avey and his story. And they are, of course, this chairman of it, Lord Greville Janner, who became in 2000 something, Lord Janner of Brownstone. He went from being an MP in the Labour Party to being in the House of Lords, where he cannot be thrown out. And this is at Inconvenient History Revisionist Blog. And you can also find it. You can Google it, and you'll find it there. You can also find it at my website, CarolynJaeger.com, and you can also find it at all these names of things, revisionistworkshop.com, area content, Fritzburg site. All right, now, to go on with this, though, I've gone on to find out from some people who informed me about this, of this Greville Janner's ties to, whoops, I didn't get where I wanted to go to. Greville Janner's ties to pedophilia. This Greville Janner, this Lord Janner, who is so instrumental in helping Dennis Abbey and promoting not only him and his story, but so many others. All Holocaustology stands as an accused pedophile who has never answered the charges. And I'm getting more and more information about him. He is not only accused of taking advantage of a young boy who was in a children's home from the age of this boy was from 13 until he was 15. And he had a relationship with him in which he, well, in fact, sodomized him. And the boy was attached to him in a way. And you know, anyway, I have all of that. But on the other, there's something more that I haven't written about yet. And that is that this Janner has a big property in Israel. And he, as I understand it, he stole, or, you know, like they all do, stole it from Palestinians, and he has a big house, and there he has a shrine there to his father. And now I want to tell you that his father immigrated as a child to Britain from Lithuania. They were Lithuanian Jews, and they immigrated. His father's parents immigrated to Britain, and when his father was a child, and so he is just a second generation British, but he's already a lord, a peer of the realm, and there are a lot more too. I mean, it's just amazing. And he has this big place in Israel, which he stole from, he actually stole this from a Palestinian family, as I understand it. And he has a lot of events going on there, and all with Jews, all Jews. And he has been not only is he president of the Holocaust Education Trust, but he has been president of the Commonwealth Jewish Council. He's a former president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, a very big organization. And he's vice president of the World Jewish Congress. He's just everything is Jewish with him. And yet he is called Lord Janner Brownstone, as though he's a British peer. You see how this works? And he gets away with his pedophilia because, as a matter of fact, Gordon Brown has been accused of pedophilia, and many of the top Labour Party politicians, and the whole Labour Party has been involved in seriously in all the immigration that's gone into Britain and turning Britain into a non-British, non-English nation. So the whole thing goes together, as I told you. I'm summing up here now because it is it's politics, ladies and gentlemen. It's politics. Holocaust fits in with the politics of the time, with the with the dictatorial rule of these elites that have taken over since World War II, and of course it goes back before that, but there is a certain beginning that took place at the end of World War II. And so to bring it all back together, we need to be very forceful in bringing down Holocaust, because we can't do it any other way. Good night, and it was nice that you're with me tonight.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.